I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast. Today, we have Melissa Schick joining us. Melissa is a doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at the University of Rhode Island and the student representative to the Executive Committee of the Society of Addiction Psychology. She'll be talking to us today about her work on strength-based approaches to understanding substance use in Indigenous youth. Really excited to have her on.
Melissa, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about your training?
Yeah, definitely. So kind of going back to the beginning, I guess, I did my bachelor's degree in psychology at Suffolk University in Boston. I kind of went into a psychology degree, not because I had any intention of like being a psychologist. I kind of went into college being like, I do not want to be a psychologist. I don't want to be a full-time therapist. And that's like kind of all I thought that psychologists did.
Oh, right. Me too.
So I kind of was like, yeah, psychology is just kind of like a general liberal arts degree and I'll figure out what I want to do from there. So I kind of went all through college planning on either being an elementary school teacher or a lawyer. I like studied.
Those are basically the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So different. I like studied for the LSAT and everything. Wow. You know, I was like fully intent on those paths. And then in my last year of undergrad, I had to do an internship and I ended up doing a research internship at the Mass General Hospital Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Unit, working on a project that was trying to validate a measure to be used at well child visits in the state of Massachusetts for like mental health screenings. And I was kind of blown away because I had never really realized that A, psychologists do research, but B, that psychology research could have really real world macro level implications.
Right.
So I remember working on that project and being like, holy cow, like this is something that like pediatricians are gonna use like when kids come into their office, and it could, you know, kind of inform whether kids get the care and the services that they need. And that is so important.
Yeah.
So I decided not to pursue education or law and to kind of like get more experience in psychology to see if it was something I wanted to stick with, and ended up approaching and being accepted into the lab by one of my professors at the time, Lance Swenson, who was doing research in adolescent risk and kind of childhood relationships, but then also his lab had a whole lot going on. In terms of like risk behaviors more broadly, and did some work with them. And then once I graduated, Lance introduced me to Bettina Hupner at the Mass, which is one of her research coordinators for 3 years before finally applying to the University of Rhode Island, where I have been since 2016 as a graduate student in the clinical psych PhD program. So, you know, didn't end up like on the path that I thought I'd be on, and definitely didn't think I would be in the place that I am now when I started undergrad, but have also like been so excited to find this like professional path that makes me excited to do the things that I'm doing.
It never turns out exactly how you expect it to. Usually it's still pretty good. So not always, I guess, but I'm glad to hear that this has been a good journey. And I mean, you've been in the community, it sounds like, psychology community since 2013 almost.
Yeah. So wow. I started working. It was kind of hard to get a degree after undergrad a job after undergrad. I got a degree from undergrad. But to get a job, because I like hadn't set myself up for it really during undergrad. Like I didn't know about introducing myself to professors and asking them if I could join the lab literally until my last semester. So I worked at Starbucks for a while and then started working for Bettina in early 2014 and was just like really lucky that she, you know, was someone who from the beginning of my time working with her was super encouraging in terms of like fostering me as a scientist, but also fostering me as like a member of the addiction psychology community. So like introducing me to people and like encouraging me to learn more about different paths and to network and to like be really engaged and involved. So Bettina like kind of gave me my start in the community. Yeah. And I think I have her to thank for a lot of it.
Shout out Bettina Hoppner, by the way, who's just been so great to so many people over the years, myself included, has just been instrumental in introducing me to people and giving me opportunities to allow me to kind of achieve independence in this space, and just been such a thoughtful person in my personal growth. And so I'm so great to hear that she's been the same for you. And shout out if anybody who knows her is listening, or if she's listening. And then also, right, like after all of that stuff, then you just like matched at one of the best clinical psychology internships in the country, right?
Yep. I'll be starting at the Charleston Consortium in Charleston, South Carolina this summer on their general track, which I'm really excited for. Yeah.
That's right. Medical University of South Carolina, one of the very best in the country. Got one of the best scholars that we got coming out, ready to start doing some work down there.
And, so, you know, I haven't been to the beach in like a year and a half or two or three. I don't even remember. So I'll be coming to visit, I suppose.
Obviously.
You know what's so funny about that is that I was like, oh, Charleston, South Carolina, that's so exciting. Like, I'll go to the beach because they have really pretty beaches. But I'm coming from Rhode Island, which is
which is
pretty much all beaches.
On the beach, right.
But I never go.
Rhode Island is a funny state. It's the ocean state, but it touches very little ocean. What it touches is a giant bay.
Yes.
Right? It has like this tiny two little strips at the bottom that touch the actual ocean, right? But it is basically like entirely connected to water. And so, so it's probably not going to be that big of a difference. What will be a difference though is the weather.
The weather will be different. Yes.
Will be significantly different in weather.
Right.
So much warmer. And I've always lived in New England. I like grew up in Connecticut and then went to undergrad and lived in Boston. And now I'm in Rhode Island. So very excited to live in a place where it's warm.
Nice. Yeah. Right. Not only warm, it'll also be a series of interesting new experiences clinically and from a research perspective, culturally. Charleston, South Carolina is very different than New England in a lot of meaningful ways. And I think that's important.
Yeah, definitely.
As you're training to get these diverse experiences, which is great. And also congrats, because that's just such a huge, huge lift.
Thanks
trying
so
to do
much.
The whole match thing and all that stuff. So congrats.
It's behind you, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's crazy to, I was talking to some folks from my program about how, you know, when I first came in, I remember my first year people matching for internship, but being like, yeah, but they're like real people. Like that makes sense. Like I'll never be there. So to be there now just feels very
surreal. Yeah.
Yeah. It is very surreal. I wish that I could say that changes. But here I'm like first year faculty and it's the same.
Yeah, it just feels like the nature of the beast.
Yeah, just kind of like, should I be here?
Right.
I think they call it imposter syndrome. I'm pretty sure they call it imposter syndrome. I'm familiar with it. It's just an interesting experience. But I think it also helps us. For me, it's helpful to like think about it because it helps me stay motivated and do the things that are values consistent in my work and all those kinds of things. And so it is interesting though. I remember that exact experience too in my first year, listening to people match and I'm like, oh, but those people are so prepared and everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like I'll never be prepared like they are, or I'll, you know.
Then you mess around and match one of the best in the country.
Right.
How
there
the
we
tables
go.
Have turned. Exactly.
That's how you do it, folks.
That's how it's done.
Well, congratulations again. And it's been a few months since all that happened. I'm glad we're getting to sit here and talk about a little bit, and I'm sure it'll come before you know it, you'll be moving. We're really excited to have you here to talk about your research with us today. I mean, that's what got you to MUSC, I guess. So Could you tell us a little bit about your program of research?
Yeah, definitely. So I mentioned I started when I was an undergrad in a child and adolescent psychology, and then like adolescent risk stuff. When I moved over into Bettina's lab, I just was really kind of drawn into substance use research. As we all know, like among the most preventable causes of mortality and morbidity that exists, but also kind of a behavior that, like, in certain contexts and in certain ways is pretty socially acceptable, depending, I guess, on the substance. And I just thought that was so interesting. But then I also was really drawn in by kind of Bettina's approach to things, which is thinking about things from a positive psychology approach, and thinking a lot about kind of how boosting people's happiness and focusing specifically on well-being can help foster recovery. So when I was applying to grad school, I applied to programs where I could continue to do work in substance use. And I think, you know, the world just kind of pushed me to URI, and that when I applied, my advisor, Nakia Spillane, wasn't on the website, so I didn't apply to work with her, but my application somehow got passed along to her.
Wow.
And it ended up just being like a really great fit. She was a pretty new faculty member coming from Brown who had been working with Chris Kaler on his positive psych for smoking cessation projects while she was a postdoc and then a research scientist at Brown. So we kind of originally connected, and she took me because of my interest in positive psychology, because I was particularly interested in thinking about how we could leverage positive psychology to address substance use. Hmm. So I came in saying that I wanted to use it to kind of understand how we could reduce risk in college students' first 6 weeks of college. Because I was like, that's the time that, like, people are really experiencing the most risk. That's the time when you're at the highest risk for, like, experiencing sexual violence, all of these, like, negative alcohol-related consequences. So I want to really know, like, if we boost people's happiness and positive emotions, will that decrease the likelihood that they will, you know, experience negative alcohol-related consequences or drink, you know, heavily enough that they're experiencing harm? And then kind of throughout my time in grad school, I got to work on Dr. Spillane's work, which focuses more on North American Indigenous adolescents in particular, and North American Indigenous communities kind of broadly. But during my first year, she was working on her K award that was trying to identify competing life reinforcers to substance use for First Nation adolescents. So things that would provide reinforcement to reduce the risk that adolescents would engage in substance use to try and delay initiation. And I got to work with her on that project, and I kind of came through working on that to realize how an approach that would focus on promoting folks' strengths and promoting resilience would be more well received perhaps by communities who, like, research has kind of always taken a deficit focus for. And so my research interest really kind of took a hard shift into also focusing on Indigenous communities as kind of a health disparity community to think more about, you know, instead of focusing on college students and applying positive psych to college students, focusing on applying positive psych kind of as a framework to substance use in Indigenous communities.
So still getting to use that sort of protective factor, strength-based sort of spin, but using it in a different population. It's very, I think, obvious to most people that college student populations are high risk. That's like the most overstudied. I mean, it's important. I study college student stuff, but it's important. But from what I understand, you know, many of the indigenous populations are, it's also a high risk group. And it's understudied, is my understanding. So could you talk to us a little bit about that risk?
Yeah, definitely. So before I do that, I want to also just like note that I'm a white person, like doing research in this area. And I think it's just important to note that because like, I'm not a member of these communities. I try to be really mindful about not making, you know, just noting that, so I'm not an expert in these communities, though I do work in this area. But
it's
yes.
It's also important to know, right, that like these communities also are very different across,
totally.
Right?
Oh,
like,
right. Yeah.
When you totally. when we say the word indigenous, right, we're talking about like a series of cultural heritages and tribes that are living near reservations or protected lands, right, in what is now considered North America.
Right.
Yeah.
Historically, right. But there's a lot that make them similar in their traditions and in their shared heritage. But there's also a lot about that makes them unique, right? And so there's a couple of factors here that I think are important, like disclosures at the onset of when we start to talk about kind of like larger population related issues. Please continue. Sorry.
No, that's super, super important. And one of the things I was going to say is, so when I'm talking about like North American indigenous populations, I'm specifically talking about folks who are kind of called like Native Americans or American Indians in the United States, and then First Nations in Canada, though there are also others. Yeah, there's a huge amount of variability. So there's something like 570 federally recognized tribes just in the United States, and a huge number in Canada. So there's a huge amount of variability, you know, hard to talk in generalizations, nor I suppose should you talk in generalizations. But when we're thinking about risk in terms of, I'll specifically talk about alcohol use just because that's what I've done the most in. But you kind of see some of that variability. So, North American indigenous populations tend to have the highest rates of, problematic alcohol use. So that's heavy drinking and binge drinking, and also have the highest rates of consequences associated with alcohol use. But at the same time, they also actually tend to report the highest rates of abstinence, which I think is a really kind of important but also difficult thing to like hold at the same time. And pretty much every paper I've ever sent to a journal, some reviewer has been like, how can both these things be true? And I do just think it's important to note, because I think it really speaks to the fact that there is some resilience and is some protective factors at play there that are protecting some folks. But then I also think speaks to kind of like the you know, not to get real heavy here, but like racist nature of like who experiences consequences associated with alcohol use.
Yeah, totally.
So when we're thinking about kids, which is what most of my research is focused on, like who is most likely to get in trouble in school, period? Who's most likely to have run-ins with the law, period?
Yeah.
You know, so all else being equal, like if a white kid is drinking and a Native kid is drinking, like who's going to experience the consequences? Like base rates would just tell us it's not going to be the white kid.
Yeah.
But you know, with that being said, Native populations experience a huge degree of health disparities, related to alcohol use. They have higher rates of, cirrhosis, higher rates of like liver disease, higher rates of suicidality and depression, type 2 diabetes, you know, all of these health disparities that we know are linked to alcohol use.
Yeah, no, I think it's really helpful for me to always go in understanding like the scope, like the prevalence and the scope of the problem. And yeah, and it also, I think there can be a tendency to put that on the population group as a quality about them or something about, you know, a characteristic of Native Americans, for example, when really like What do you think is really actually going on there, Melissa?
Yeah. So, a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of work in this area. Joe Gaughan at Harvard and Maria Yellowhorse Braveheart at University of New Mexico Health Science Center have done a lot of work in this area, talking about historical trauma right, as a really important piece that's underlining this. So, you know, you're right. There, I think, are a lot of stereotypes surrounding alcohol use with Native populations. But I think that an important thing to note is that history is that, you know, Native communities didn't have distilled forms of alcohol prior to European contact, you know, and there are, you know, documented examples of like settlers or colonizers, I'll say, giving alcohol to Native peoples to like kind of incapacitate them and like to promote their own trade interests and things like that. But then also when we think about kind of the like injustices that Native communities have and continue to experience,
right?
You know, things like forced relocation from their land and genocide and, you know, even more recently, like the legacy of residential schools in the US and Canada where kids were taken from their homes.
That is wild stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not to mention the adoption program in New York State and otherwise.
Yeah.
Where they wanted to take Native youth and adopt them out to white families.
Right.
To.
Yeah. So there was this whole phenomenon that, for any podcast listeners out there, the CBC, which is the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, did a really good series about this called Missing and Murdered. But in season two, they focus on what was called the 60s scoop, which was essentially across the US and Canada, kids being like just taken from their families when their parents were Native and adopted out to white families because it was seen as like better for the kids to not be raised within their culture.
Right. It, well, and it's like, and we talked about this a little bit before we got on the call, but it's part of the whole tactic of the war on drugs, which is to, which is a racist set of policies put into place early in the 20th century that have lasted until now, until it was officially called the war on drugs in the 80s. But it's to destroy a community in such a way that there is really no identity. There's nothing left. There's no connection. And it's a racist white tactic of white colonialism that facilitates addiction.
Yeah. And it goes back well beyond that, even especially when you're talking about Native populations. So,
yeah,
so absolutely. I am a Native. I'm from the Costanoan Rums and Carmel tribe in California, and it has that many names for several reasons, many of which are relevant to this exact point. So in California, all of the missions in California were associated with the with settlers from Spain. And in order to be able to keep the natives, in order to be able to keep the land, you had to marry a white person. And so the Spanish people called my tribe the Costanoan tribe, which means coastal natives. We called ourselves the Rumsen tribe because that was that's what other tribes called us because that was our dialect. We're part of the Ohlone people. And Carmel is the town where the mission is, right? And so everybody called us something different, right? But like there's nobody in my entire tribe that I know of that has like the first question I get asked when I tell somebody I'm Native heritage, they say, how much? Which never happens. If I said I was Black or I was Asian, nobody would be like, how much? Which is a microaggression in its own right.
Yeah.
But in order, there's nobody who's like 100% because you had to marry what? So like, if you go back a couple generations of my family, it suddenly transfers over to Spanish names. Right. So like my great grandmother's name is Guadalupe Garcia. Right. Because they had to marry a Spanish person to keep their land, right? But and so it just like it
you
just
carry gets, like the history of these policies.
Yeah. So all of that stuff gets baked into the cake And then also forced relocations away from your land, and, you know, think just like historic atrocities, Trail of Tears, all these types of things. And then your place in where reservations are, historically, with a few exceptions, are kind of isolated places off away from and disconnected from larger resources that allow, you know, communities to thrive in modern day America. And so there's these kind of like vestigial things that have kind of come about that place those communities at risk. And it's hardly associated with like a person's biology, right? Like, it's not like their DNA code, even though there are specific things about processing alcohol and things like that due to its late introduction into those communities that do place them at risk, right? But they're like, it's about this like really thick tapestry of atrocities and forced relocations and forced marriages and things that have happened that have placed those communities at greater risk in general. And then you interface that then with racist policies that were designed for, you know, Black Americans in the South, Hispanic Americans in the Southwest, right? Native populations in California, South Dakota, New Mexico, right? Canada, all that stuff. Then you got your residential schools, you got your adoption programs, all that stuff combined really sets a community up to have poor outcomes. And that's I think that's a classic example of what we would like to refer to as systemic racism based health disparities.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so hard because I say like historical trauma has been linked to alcohol and alcohol related consequences. But really, like, to call it historical trauma is like kind of disingenuous because, for example, the last residential school in Canada closed in the 90s. Exactly. Like, that's not, I mean, you know, I guess I don't know at what point things become historical. But right,
but people experienced it. I mean, there are people alive
who
went there.
Exactly.
Well, and even beyond that, you have stuff like in the last few years, like the South Dakota pipeline.
Exactly.
So there, beyond even some of that stuff, I mean, there are things that are ongoing where these populations are, you know, up until Biden appointed one, you know, to
Deb
to
Holland,
his.
Yeah.
Shout
out Deb Holland.
Yeah. Which is awesome. It's very exciting. But I mean, there's never been a voice at that level of the government. For these populations, and so that's a really exciting development.
For anyone who doesn't know, Biden appointed the first Native cabinet secretary, so Deb Holland from I think New Mexico, if I remember correctly, is the Secretary of the Interior,
which directly interfaces with the Native communities and the Native lands.
Yes.
And so not only are they just being represented in the cabinet and their voice being heard, but also like has a person who's guiding like specific things that, you know, interface with their day-to-day living in these communities, which is huge.
But yeah, I mean, so not only are there people who are alive today who, you know, were at residential schools, and not only is it just now that, you know, we have our first Native cabinet member, but then also just in, I want to say it was May 2019, Justin Trudeau in Canada declared the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women a genocide. So, wow. You know, that's why I say, you know, to call it historic, it just doesn't feel like it's completely capturing, you know, some of these.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in many ways, white people, I hope, are starting to wake up to the, you know, their role in, you know, colonialism and all of the terrible things that that have happened in you know, the last, I said decades, but I mean centuries. I mean, it's been a long time. But one thing that I think is always interesting is, I don't know if you guys have heard of the app called Native Lands, but if you go in there and you can type in an address and it will tell you on what native lands you're currently standing or where you live or whatever. So it's a really good exercise. I encourage people to go do that to understand sort of like the gravity of what we've taken from people.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I think that's a huge part of it, right? As people are recognizing now and things like that. But I think an important thing that I think maybe, you know, historically research in this space hasn't paid attention to is there's a lot of really amazing stuff happening in these communities too. And there's been a lot of what we would call helicopter research over the generations where people kind of fly in and say like, whoa, there's all this problems over here. Right. And they pathologize individuals versus systems that keep individuals in specific destinations of life. And, but there's also these amazing things going on. Right. And so that's what makes you, I think your work so unique and so awesome, right. Is that this whole strength-based positive component, because there's a lot about Native and Indigenous communities that are amazing. Right. Connection to nature, spiritual practices, right. Many things from Native communities have been kind of appropriated by healing traditions all over the world, like sweat lodges and all these types of things that are going on that don't get the credit that like the kind of credit that people often ascribe to negative things with those communities. And so I think that's one of the things that makes your work so good. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what's going on in that space.
Yeah, totally. So one of the things actually that just kind of came into my mind as we were talking about criminalization of culture, one of the things that has started to come out is this idea of kind of culture is like healing and reconnecting with culture is healing. So there's been a lot of kind of calls for that in the work and some of the work that my lab has done at the University of Rhode Island or the lab that I'm in. It's not my lab, I guess.
Soon enough, Melissa, lab. You'll have a lab. Right?
You'll have a lab.
I'm projecting forward. but so Dr. Spillane's K Award, like I said, was really trying to kind of identify these reinforcers that would, you know, if available and if important to youth would delay their initiation of substance use. And one of the things that we found, in addition to kids identifying, you know, culture as something that they want and that like they see as protective, was that valuing cultural activities and availability of cultural activities moderated the link between alcohol expectancies and alcohol use. So Sylvie Goldstein was the first author on that paper. Credit where credit is due, but that was just published in JSAD. So we found that, you know, the link between alcohol expectancies and alcohol use was no longer significant for kids who reported high levels of valuing cultural activities, which I think really speaks to kind of like the importance of culture as an alternative reinforcer to substance use. And I think speaks to the importance of culture as a protective kind of healing mechanism, given that until pretty recently, it was not, you know, with the community that we work with, you know, it was not legal for them to practice their culture until pretty recently. So there, I think, is still some kind of fear sometimes, particularly among older folks in the community about kind of teaching their culture, you know, because they saw some like not so good things happen when they would do that, you know, in their own lifetimes. But that reemergence of culture being really protective.
That's so a really great point.
Plug that there.
That's a really great point, right? That Native languages are dying for this exact reason, right? Like I don't know anybody in my community that speaks the Remsen language. It's written down actually in the Smithsonian. So like the alphabet and all that stuff, which is cool, but I've never heard anybody speak it outside of like specific kind of like songs and stuff like that still exist, but I don't know anybody that speaks it in common language and in general conversational style anymore. And they're dying all over the place. Cause that was dangerous. Right. Not that long ago to speak in native language was dangerous.
Right.
Right. And
I think you're, you know, it's odd that, you know, we're seeing that culture and being able to sort of live it out is a protective factor. It keeps adolescents from engaging in something. And yet that is something that our country has systematically tried to keep from being. And so I just can't get over how much we as a country have actually perpetuated problematic substance use by our policy.
Yeah.
You know, that's another conversation.
yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Yeah.
It's wild that like the expectancy. So it's not even that the adolescent doesn't, you know, want to use it or think that it might be fun or something like that, but that it just does not lead to drug or to alcohol use.
Yeah. And I think that's what we thought was really interesting is, you know, maybe what's happening there is they're like, yeah, you know, like drinking might be fun. Like it might make me more social at parties or whatever. But I'm getting all of this reinforcement from like practicing my culture. And I think especially in the community that we work with, at least you can't engage in things like ceremony if you've used substances. You have to be substance free to engage in certain ceremonies. So I think, you know more than I do, Sam, about like the behavioral choice stuff. But if we think about like the decision, you know, decision, I used air quotes for folks who are listening, to engage in substance being kind of like a ratio of relative cost and availability of substances and then relative cost and availability of alternative reinforcers, it seems like maybe what's happening is just that, like, you know, the ratio is tipping in favor of those cultural practices. So it's not that, you know, alcohol wouldn't do these good things for me. It's that like, I'm getting so much reinforcement from this other place that like, you know, the relative value of alcohol is less.
Yeah. That's music to my ears, Melissa. Yeah.
yeah.
I love hearing it. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about, you know, we talk about how alcohol is an immediate reinforcer and then, you know, all of these other things are delayed reinforcers. Well, if you haven't been getting delayed reinforcers, you're not getting them now. If you have been, or if you've been engaging in things that are, you know, that their reinforcement is delayed in nature, then you're getting some of that reinforcement simultaneous with the, you know, the choice to possibly engage in something like alcohol, which is an immediate reinforcer. So it's competing in that moment. Mm-hmm. You know what you're going to lose because you're experiencing it. So being able to just engage with those alternatives. Yeah.
And I would even suggest that some of those cultural practices, because they're social in nature, actually have immediate reward.
That's exactly right. What I was going to say. Yeah. Is that, No. But that's just, you know, right where my head was going to was that I would imagine because, you know, some of these ceremonies and some of these cultural practices, like you said, Noah, are social in nature. You know, there probably is some immediate reward that the kids are getting there where they're like being in their community and like, you know, having a good time with their friends and family members.
Yeah. And this gets into developmental theory around, right, like social rewards as a function of brain development in teens, right? So is it Sternberg's work, Lawrence Sternberg or Steinberg, showed that teens respond more to social rewards than like, you know, young adults, then older adults, things like that. And that's what facilitates risk taking is because of the peer like social kind of contract and reinforcement that you get from being the person who surfed on the top of a car and everybody saw it and you're a badass now, right? Like you get that social currency and reward for that, right? And that in communities that have infrastructure where, you know, you get social rewards from participating in cultural practices that are perhaps, you know, incompatible with substance use, specifically where they say you can't, right? Then that actually might supersede it just based on the specific developmental period of teens coupled with, you know, cultural identity and spiritual practices that are kind of endemic to those communities, right? And I think that's really, really huge. And also this is all what you're talking about here is really in line with what we see when we just look kind of broader scope at marginalized youth in general, right? So if you look at some of the stuff from like Adam Leventhal and folks like that, they show that individuals who are in lower SES, things like that, tend to have less access to alternative reinforcers and therefore are more likely to engage in substance use, right? And so if you think of reservation life or even urban dwelling native youth, where do they typically live? right? In places with lower SES, things like that. So they become reinforcement deserts, basically, with things that aren't substance use, right? So it's really kind of all bound up in the fabric of these communities based on how the community has been placed in this position by kind of historical policy and so forth.
Yeah, I think the other thing that just makes me think about is, again, you know, recognizing that there's a lot of variability and we don't want to make generalizations, sure. But is that like Native communities tend to be more kind of interdependent than, you know, most other like racial and ethnic groups in the US. So I wonder if like just kind of the salience of the reward from those more socially based cultural activities is just kind of, again, even amping up like how reinforcing engaging with culture is.
Yeah. They tend to be close-knit communities in way, mm-hmm. and they tend to be kind of, some of them are fairly isolated, like mm-hmm. Rosebud Reservation, for instance, South Dakota, is like hours away from anything, mm-hmm. right? And so it's, you know, to be able to have social awards from your immediate contacts, people that have a lot of meaning in your life, mm-hmm. right, moderates, I think, that the magnitude of the reward for it. Mm-hmm. And I think I know there's not a lot of work in this space right now, but I also think there's a lot of opportunity for us to engage with communities, Native communities, and help them kind of amp up the positive reinforcement to some of the things that are existing in these communities, to help kind of belay risk to some of these outcomes.
Yeah.
And I think that's like that's the future of the work, right? And I know a lot of people have focused on deficit based models and things like that. And that's probably how we end up with, you know, adoption programs or whatever, you know, in addition to racism. Right. But I think that there's really a lot of ground that we can work with these communities doing, you know, community-based participatory research and things like that. And so I was just wondering where you think that the future for this is.
Yeah, I think one of the important things, and I know you mentioned kind of this idea of like helicopter research already, but is, you know, thinking about when working with communities that you're not, you know, you're working with communities, you're not doing research on communities.
Yeah.
You know, like the importance of kind of taking that like within approach.
Yeah.
And also I think valuing like thinking about Indigenous groups in particular, but like Indigenous ways of knowing and Indigenous ways of like healing. But, you know, maybe a more immediate future of like where some of this can go. I'm currently working at a project that my advisor has an R34 through NIAAA for, where she is actually using kind of behavioral activation plus positive psychology to develop a prevention program for Indigenous youth. So we've just finished like a first draft of the manual, and we're going to be doing focus groups in the next couple of weeks to get some feedback from kids who are living in the reserve community that we partner with, but then also adults in the community on ways that we can think about, you know, some of these interventions being more culturally appropriate. So like, for example, you know, I mentioned that I'm really interested in thinking about ways to use positive psychology. You know, positive psychology, was really like developed based on pretty, you know, individual level, ideas. So thinking about things like, you know, individual level flourishing. So if we're thinking about ways to like use positive psychology to prevent substance use, like there might be things that we need to do to make it more appropriate, like making it focus more on, you know, thinking about times that your community or your family were flourishing, or thinking about times that you were of service to your family or your community, or expressing gratitude to your community or your culture or the creator or whatever, you know, is salient for the individual. But I really think, you know, that's something that my advisor is doing right now.
Yeah.
But I do think that like an important area for future research is really, you know, and it feels almost silly to say it, but like really is not like for us to say, but it's for folks to partner with communities and hear from them about what they need and like what would be helpful, because communities have been calling for these strengths-based approaches and calling for folks to consider, you know, ways in which communities have been resilient and individuals have been resilient. But researchers have kind of said like, well, that's not what I find interesting personally. So I'm going to instead focus on, you know, this, whatever it is, or that's not what I think will be salient. So I'm going to focus on this. So I really think that like, you know, the future will be, you know, more folks learning community-based methods to be able to hear from communities about, like I said, what they need, what will be helpful, and for that to kind of really inform progress.
I am always struck by how much people know what they need, are able, like if you just listen to people, they can tell you exactly what's going to help them out. And they're not trying to fool you or get something from you.
That's the thing right there.
They're just telling you what they need.
That's the thing, right? And there's always an expert in the room, right?
Yep.
It's the person that we're working with, right? Whether that's a client or a community or any of those things. And the problem is that historically, that's not been the vision.
Right. Well, right. I think historically, like we think about it like, oh, like the scientist is the expert. And it's like, you know, I think a lot of doing this research has actually kind of informed my clinical practice because, you know, it's like, okay, like I've had some training in some like models and theories and like I can run some analyses, but I'm not the expert on you.
Right.
I'm not going to be able to say like, here's what's going to work.
Right. Well, and it's always interesting to see when our theoretical models go across, you know, it sort of explains the phenomenon in a different group. You know, we hope that to be true all the time. And I think generally some of our more robust theories do, but the thing is that when you assume that everyone, and I think that this applies when you're talking about working with Native American populations, but it applies with just your clients. Like if you go in to a room and you give them a sheet of paper and tell them to fill out the worksheet, you know, on their thoughts, like maybe targeting thoughts or targeting behavior, maybe those are, you know, the mechanisms. But the process by which you actually address those and you work with the individual to change is very different. And we've been so stuck, I think, on those, you know, those specific approaches, you know, that we sometimes forget that we're going for something underneath that rather than
That's a product of several factors, right? Like one is lack of evidence-based practice historically, and then the need for the RCT, which meant the need for the manual, which now has created kind of handcuffs for a lot of folks. And so we got to kind of get back to our roots in some of this in meaningful ways. And I think I'm always really struck by what Sam said and by what you've said, Melissa, is this like a little bit about like how communities know what they need. And they've been saying it for a long time. And that's really what it means to be an ally in some ways and to partner with these communities, is to allow us to use our privilege as educated people who have positions of power in various ways to advocate for those research dollars, to help those communities get those things off the ground, to use community participatory research approaches where we train individuals in those communities to allow those to be sustainable processes for if research funding were to be removed, that they would be able to continue these practices because it's what they want, it's what they need, and they know how to do it, right? And those are the things, I think, and that's challenging and takes a long time. And you know, the world that we live in is a publish or perish world at times, right? And those things don't line up, and so it can be incredibly challenging. And so people doing work like you're talking about doing are really just doing such amazing work that really doesn't get the kind of credit it probably deserves. And that's why I'm really glad we're able to have you on to highlight this work, because what you're talking about is like decades of work, right? For like this paper you talked about with Sylvie that I literally just read yesterday for a different project I'm working on, probably took 5 years, right?
And I think that that's like, you know, like, I think that more people need to do this kind of community engaged work, and not just with Indigenous communities, but like with all communities.
Yeah,
individuals in recovery, right?
Totally.
Individuals experiencing homelessness, like pick of some of the people that we work with. Those people have, they're experts.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I'm telling you, you work with an individual experiencing homelessness and ask them what they need, they will tell you. Right. And it's sometimes what you think it is, and a bunch of time, not what you think it is. Right.
Right. Or maybe like it is what you think it is, but like, you know, we all have our own perspectives and our own biases that we're bringing to our processes. So if I think, you know, oh, well, I know how to do this, so like, it's probably pretty straightforward, or, well, I know that this, you know, resource exists, so it's probably like pretty easy to access. Like, you know, that's not necessarily the case. So it might be that folks need what you think they need, but they might need it in a different way than what you're thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like when we had Susan Collins on and Seema Cliff-Acefi, mm-hmm. right? Like housing first, right? Like, you think, oh, they need treatment for alcohol use disorders. Like, what they need is a place to live.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Like, I'm telling you, it's almost impossible to get a job if you don't have a place to live and a phone to call and a computer to access and clothes for an interview. Like, there's like 1,000 barriers. Yeah. It's not just like bootstraps, right? Like the classic line from MLK, right? Which is like, it's a cruel jest to ask a person to pull themselves up by their, it asks a bootless person to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Hmm. Right. And so, and then that's why I think this work is so important, and focusing on positive stuff, right? So historically, even just psychology as a general was focused on negative. Let's eliminate negative thoughts, let's eliminate negative mood and all that stuff. But there's all these really potent components to positive emotions, like the undoing process, right? Which is by increasing positive emotion, it actually reduces the intensity of any co-occurring negative emotion. You may have experienced this in your life when you've been really distressed, and then somebody you know who's your support cracks a joke. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you laugh a little bit, even though you're crying. But the intensity of that distress is lessened by that moment. That's the undoing process. You can do that on a community wide scale, right? To help with, you know, some of the after effects of historical trauma and things like this, by allowing communities to really celebrate their cultural heritage and to leverage that to allow their, you know, their teens, their elders, all them to reap the benefits of it.
Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting, because I think, so like positive psych, you know, which like is my shtick. So that's why I keep mentioning it, but really has only been around since Martin Seligman's like presidential address in 2000. I mean, like some of this idea, you know, Maslow wrote about the hierarchy of needs. Yep. And I think it was like Aristotle or one of those guys like talked about eudaimonia and like, kind of just like well-being being important. But really what Martin Seligman said in his address was that psychology has done an okay job at one of its goals, which is like reducing mental illness. But you don't just like, oh, I don't have depression, so like I'm great, you know, I'm flourishing. Like there's all of these other really important pieces of it too. So symptom reduction, like definitely important, definitely want to help people get there, but it's insufficient. You know, when people also have all of these like really positive characteristics and qualities and communities and things like that, that can be nourished. And that kind of both of those things, like low mental illness and high mental wellness, like those are actually both necessary components of flourishing.
Yeah.
Or of living your kind of best life.
Well said. Well said. Right. Necessary, but not sufficient.
Right.
Right. And that by simply improving other areas of your life, it actually kind of shaves off some of the hard edges on some of those symptoms. You know, ACT talks about this, right? You know, some mindfulness-based approaches talk about this. And I'm glad to see that it's starting to really permeate down into these community-based participatory works, like you're talking about with your group at URI, right? Like, what you described as that next step project is like the dream project to me, right? It's like everything I like all in a single like thing to show up for a community and help like real people, like do real things to help their communities thrive. And that's just so amazing. And I don't want that to get lost in the shuffle on our conversation of like how important that work is and how awesome this group of researchers that you're included with here are doing some really amazing work.
It's kind of a shame that like recovery research and positive psych haven't talked more, you know?
I think they're trying to, right? Like Bettina's work is in that space, yep. Chris Taylor's work. I know my work's absolutely in this space. And so we just need to, that's why having episodes like this, I think, are really important to help get the word out that this is, I think, such a crucial space that just has a lot of work that needs to be done that can really help move the needle. At the end of the show, we like to have a little bit of a discussion around some key take-home messages for stakeholders that might be listening. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious what you think is kind of a take-home message from this work that you've been involved with for people in recovery who are or interested in changing their substance use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I think a lot about is kind of this like idea of symptom reduction being necessary but insufficient. So I would say like for people in recovery, you know, yeah, do the hard work of like reducing your substance use or reducing the harm that you're experiencing from substance use, like whatever your goal is. But I would say to also kind of like think about what else you're going to have in terms of like alternative reinforcers. So like find your community of people who are going to support you. Find, you know, if culture is something that's important to you, like immerse yourself in that, finding kind of those other, you know, areas of your life that are going to bring you some joy, you know, is really important. Because I think if, you know, we'd be lying if we said that substance use doesn't like serve a purpose for folks. So I think if we take away something that's serving a purpose, but don't like replace it with anything, like, I don't really know what we're doing. Yeah. So I would just say like, it's okay to also like prioritize happiness and enjoyment, yeah, you know, yes. Like all of the energy doesn't need to be focused on.
And that's your positive psychology coming out. But it's funny because that is not a message that's the first time this has come up on the podcast, I think, that I can remember at least. And it's such an important message. Because I think so many people who are going through recovery are working their ass off to not do something, to avoid something, and to think and prioritize someone's happiness. I think that's a really good point. Thank you for saying that, Melissa.
So important. And also, people in your life might think that means you're not taking it seriously, and that's a tragedy for them, not for you, right? It's really easy to avoid or not do something when you're doing something else that's awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so prioritizing your happiness and finding the things that give you joy in recovery is like one of the best messages that I think we can have on the show for anybody who's listening.
Yeah.
And that's real work to figure out. And so it's not easy and is incredibly valuable. So thank you so much, I think, for saying that.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, Melissa. What would your take home be for practitioners?
Probably kind of along the same lines. So like, I think about, you know, when I'm working with folks who are in recovery or who are kind of like working on their substance use or substance related harm, you know, like, in the CBT SUD manual, it talks about kind of talking with them about any like instances of use in the past week and cravings in the last week. But I think, you know, along similar lines, like asking what went well and like what people did that they enjoyed
they
and
loved.
That they, that they like got reinforcement from, you know, for a similar reason. Cause like you said, Noah, like, you know, even if it doesn't make it easier to not do something when you're doing something, or even if it doesn't make it easy to not do something when you're doing something else you love, it should at least make it easier.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So similar message.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's important. I think, especially for, I think substance use comes up in a lot of contexts for practitioners who aren't substance use specialists, for instance.
Totally.
And then I think that's where that stuff can really get kind of even more focused on, right? Because that seems like we got to zoom in on the craving and the such. Or family members, right? Family members out there listening, mm-hmm. right? Like they were like, what you craved? Like lock the batten down the hatches, right? Like lock them away, right? And it's like, how about we talk about like what we're really great this week? And yeah. how can we replicate that for next yeah. week, right? And like, when did you feel it? Like, right. was it at the beginning, at the end? Let's do more of that.
Yeah.
And I think even like, you know, this is, I guess, kind of also going back to like people in recovery, but I, you know, something I actually was just talking about with some clients today was kind of this idea of if you can like boost your positive emotions and like, or boost your like happiness overall and have all of these other things you're really enjoying and really getting a lot out of, like, yeah, you know, your family members might be like, oh my God, you had a craving, or like, oh my God, you drank, like, but maybe you're more able to be like, oh shoot, like that was a slip, you know, like I got to get back.
Cause there's a lot of other stuff that I'm trying to go on. Yeah,
exactly.
There's value in the process of change here that I'm able to anchor, right. That those in those waves, right.
Exactly.
Craving or negative affect or whatever they might be.
I think versus it being like, oh, well, like my whole goal has been not to use. So now that I drank, you know, once
abstinence violation like, effect.
Right. My whole thing is now over. Well, actually I've had all these goals. My goals have been to like not drink, but also like to spend a lot of time like with my kids and also to like get into this hobby that I'm like really enjoying.
Really great point. Great. Diversify your reinforcement portfolio.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Because if it's anchored exclusively on abstinence, right, like that's pretty challenging. And if in one single hiccup happens in there, then that whole thing is dashed on the rocks. And then it's easy to fall into the, you know, fuck it's right. Mm-hmm. And then next thing you know, we got a problem. Whereas like, whoa, look how amazing this was. And that doesn't like that. And you can hold both things to be true. It's that thing we talked about at the beginning that somehow, right, like Native communities can be the most abstinent and have highest rates of problems, right? Like those things can be true in recovery too. I can have amazing things and struggled on one day. And that's okay. I think that's a really important point, and I'm glad you brought it up. What would you say to policymakers out there who are listening?
Yeah, I don't know if this is like technically policymakers, but I would say like fund health disparity research.
Those are policymakers, yeah.
Okay. I think like, you know, like you said, Noah, you know, doing community engaged work is super important, but it's also hard to do. It takes a long time. Like my dissertation has been going a little bit slower than some of my peers, but it's because like, it's really important to me to be like consulting with stakeholders in the community at like every step in the process. So yeah, you know what, like my dissertation maybe is going to take a little bit longer, but it's also going to like produce valuable knowledge, I think, to both like science and to the community that I'm partnering with.
Yeah.
So like fund health disparity research. If you're a journal editor, like publish our papers. I can't tell you the number of desk rejections we've gotten saying that like Native communities are not a high priority population. And that is super disheartening. It's super important work. And so please let us do it.
Totally. That's upsetting to even hear.
Agreed.
What kind of implications does your work have for underserved populations?
See, that actually, you know, I mentioned I've listened to a lot of episodes. So I knew that question was coming, but that feels like it should be really, really an easy question, but it feels actually kind of like a hard question. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know that I have like a, okay, here's what you got to know, like right. folks from underserved communities or like, you know, I guess like that I see you and like,
yeah.
I recognize the disparities and I recognize that people recognize the disparities and the ways that like, it's the system at play. And then kind of like similar things, like find your stuff that's going to like, bring you joy and that's going to like
yeah.
give you, you know, reinforcement, you know, connecting with culture, finding a community, finding a provider who is going to be like open to the fact that like when we talk about evidence-based practice, like evidence-based practice for who, you know, like that there might need to be changes that need to be made, and that you should be in the driver's seat of those changes.
Agreed.
So I know that's not like a super like.
No, I actually think answer, that's, but... I actually think that's a really important point.
Totally.
You made, right. Like the, just the simple statement of like, I see you, I think is like a really potent message for underserved populations.
Yeah.
Many of what it means to be underserved is to be under-recognized, underappreciated, right? And so forth. Like the people aren't serving those communities because they're not paying attention. And so step one, I think, is just to be like, we see it, we understand it, we're here, and we're trying to partner with the, with your community to be able to make sure that we can show up for those communities the way that you wish it to be, right? In a sustainable, positive, focused way. And so I think, I actually think that's really, really an important one. And also shout out to the longtime listener, first time caller line in at the beginning of that. I don't want that to blow past because that's such a hilarious thing that happens in real shows. So you've been super successful in your career so far. What advice do you have for trainees out there who are listening?
So I think I would say a couple of things. One, I would say, like, not to be cliched, but like, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. I think if you like look forward at your whole career, that can be really daunting. You know, when like, you know, like I mentioned at the beginning, I remember being a first year and being like, I'll never go on internship. Like, I'm not doing a dissertation. Like, that is not some, you know, that's something like real people do, and I'm not a real person. But I think just by like focusing on what you're doing now and like what is A, needed to get you to the next step, and B, like what's bringing you passion now, like, you know, taking it a day at a time. I think that's like an AA thing too, right? Is like one day at a time. But it's true kind of graduate school, is taking it one day at a time.
Yeah.
The other thing that I'll note is just kind of like getting involved, and like putting yourself out there. So like, I mean that in a couple ways. I mean, like, tell your advisor to nominate you for stuff. Because I didn't do that for my first couple years. And then in the last year, I've been like, hey, there's an award. Like, can you nominate me?
One of those pieces of information that they don't tell you when you walk in the door. But that's that's what everyone's done. They've told people to nominate them. So,
And that's not, you know, doing that isn't like being, I mean, maybe it is a little bit like, you know, egoistic or whatever.
It's the field though, you know, it's the way things are. So,
Right. And I think it's like knowing your value.
Yeah.
I think that's an important message across all of the different capacities in which training happens, is understanding your value, and it's challenging.
Yeah. Right.
Understanding and advocating for your value.
Yeah.
Agreed.
But so I think that that's kind of part one, is like putting yourself out there in that way, but then also like getting involved in other things. You know, I think about like my involvement in Division 50. You know, it's opened so many doors for me just in terms of like networking and people that I can like go to say, hey, do you have a second to like give me your thoughts on this? Or do you have any, you know, do you know anyone here? I'm really interested in that work and I'd love to, you know, connect with this person. You know, I think really getting involved early in my graduate school career in Division 50 has been like a huge part of my success. So with that, I'll also put in a quick plug for, so Sam and I are actually the student representatives currently for Division 50, and our student research grant is due on May 1st. So that is four awards for up to $1,000 plus $500 for travel. One of those is the President's Award. The theme for this year is implementing a public health approach to addiction. So one will be selected that's of high quality and that's well aligned with that theme. One for the first time this year is going to be selected that's of high quality and focused on underserved populations or health disparities. And then two more will be selected that are just kind of high scientific quality. So if you haven't already, you should apply to get some money for your research. That's one of those things, both like getting involved and putting yourself out there.
It's only 3 pages long. I mean, with a couple other recommendation letters and stuff, it's $1,000 and can help you jumpstart your research. And we would love to see applications.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And even if you don't get it, you get back reviews from leaders in the field who looked over your project. That can really make inroads to collaborations in the future, that can help you kind of refine your research program or ideas around it. So there's value put in an application, and even though there's only so many that are selected, for anybody who puts in an application, I really think there's actual real world value in putting in an application regardless of the outcome. And then the outcome is sweet.
Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for coming on and just chatting with us today. This has been a really awesome conversation about a topic that I think we're all, really passionate about. So thanks for bringing your expertise to the table. It's been awesome.
Agreed.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Yeah, of course.
Our pleasure.
Next time on The Addiction Psychologist, we'll have Dr. John Kelly join us. John is an endowed professor of psychiatry and addiction medicine at Harvard Medical School, the founder and director of the Recovery Research Institute at Massachusetts General Hospital, the program director of the Addiction Recovery Management Service, and associate director of the Center for Addiction Medicine at MGH. He'll be talking to us about his groundbreaking work on addiction stigma and recovery science. Could not be more excited to have him join us. You cannot miss this episode.